You and I getting together, wrapping up a very busy week, Friday, December 15th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. I had a few thoughts to kick off the program on the so far successful use of license plate readers around the state to help police solve cases. We welcome Steve Babson, author of Forgotten Populists, When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy, and former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso stopped by with his weekly update. So I looked up before I started the show today on this Friday, December 15th. I've just passed a personal career milestone. I promise I'll tell you about that later in the hour, because I think it's something to be quite proud of myself. It's taken me years and years to get to this point, so I'll let you in on a little secret, something I'm a little on the prideful side of today, proud today. So we'll get you that momentarily. How many of you, and let me state it this way, because this is how I like to think about this. How many of you care if you're being watched out there? Now, let's assume that you have privacy inside of your home, inside of your domicile, inside of your house, of your apartment, of your condo, of your townhouse, of your tent, of your cardboard box, you know, whatever your current living condition might be. You probably, and you would be right constitutionally and legally to say, hey, I'm home. Whatever tired thing you want to say about a man's or woman's home is his or her or their castle. I think under most law, you would be right with that. Nobody has the right to peer into your home unless it's a criminal investigation, or I believe it has been held up by courts that if you're doing whatever in front of your window and your blinds are up or your curtains are not closed or your darkening shades are not closed and you can be seen doing what you're doing in front of that window because you enjoy doing that or whatever, I don't think you can claim privacy on that one. But so when you're home, I get it. Generally, I keep my blinds down, although I'm on the top floor of a high-rise, so pretty much only the birds would see me or somebody with a high-powered telescope from somewhere on the other side of town. But I digress. Now, when we're outside, right, when we step out of a door, when we leave our house, our condo, our apartment, our townhome, our cardboard box, our igloo, our little mud hut, whatever we call home, you can be seen, and we take our cars on public roads, public as they are defined thoroughfares. Now, I'm not a crook. I'm not stealing cars. I'm not kidnapping anyone, at least anymore. Kidding. I'm not a crook. I'm not kidnapping anyone. I'm not dealing drugs. I don't have illegal guns with me. I'm just kind of your average white, middle-aged, pudgy, balding, suburban guy who comes to work every day and may, on the way home, pick up some chicken and broccoli somewhere or, you know, be going to the store or taking a drive down to the train station to go to see my son and his girlfriend in New York, whatever. So if people want to look at me or surveil me, I don't care. I honestly don't care. Now, if it gets a little creepy, if it's somebody who hears me on the radio and disagrees with me to the point where they may do me harm, then I've got a problem with that. If it's somebody that decides to show up at my home one day because he wants to discuss something that I said on the air, which did happen once, but it was okay. He was very harmless, nice guy. I think he's passed right now. He was a little elderly back then. That I may have a problem with. But in general, I don't care because I'm not a crook. And what am I talking about here? You remember it was about a year and a half ago, I think. You may remember, though. We have discussed on this show, and I've given you my opinion on this, that I don't care if there are license plate readers out there, right? We talked about this story once before. And local police and state police, the only thing they will say is there maybe as many as 90 or so license plate readers out there in public, on public thoroughfares, watching for cars, trucks, vans, RVs, moving vehicles who have specific license plates, who may be looking for bad guys or bad gals. And there's an interesting story today in the Connecticut Post by Eric Bednar, staff writer for Hearst Connecticut Media. As Connecticut police tout their recent use of license plate readers, advocates say transparency is a concern. All right. So let's get into this a little bit, because now the cops are coming out across the state, and these are local police, and I think state police too, saying, see, this is why we have these license plate readers out there. Now, as far as I'm concerned, unless you're a crook, you shouldn't worry about it. But we have the usual suspects out there, some minority groups, the ACLU, saying, hey, you know, we have to be careful to make sure this isn't abused. Well, okay, I get that, but unless somebody has some personal vendetta against you and they are tracking your license plate, I don't think we need layers and layers and layers of legislation and do-gooders in Hartford getting in the way of the cops on this. And I guess the police are starting to say, hey, this is good the way it is. Let's give you a couple of examples. In one incident in Southington, okay, and again, these are in this story here at Hearst Connecticut Media. In one recent incident in Southington, two Waterbury residents were found with a handgun modified to be fully automatic, as well as more than 600 bags of fentanyl packaged for sale. The arrest began with a notification from the police department's stationary license plate system that ID'd a stolen vehicle that had just entered their town. Okay, so do we understand what's going on here? These weren't guys or gals running down to New Haven to apply to get into Yale. Apparently. Two Waterbury residents found with a handgun modified to be fully automatic, as well as more than 600 bags of fentanyl packaged for sale. I'll read it again. The arrest began with a notification from the police department's stationary license plate system that ID'd a stolen vehicle that had just entered their town. So obviously, if a vehicle is stolen, this system, it would appear, has a capacity, you can enter that plate, and if the system gets a hit on it, they'll let you know where it is. So basically, you don't have to have cruisers or men and women in uniform out there kind of aimlessly driving around, maybe in a marked vehicle where the bad guys or bad girls will say, hey, there's a cop over there, go the other way, right? Let's give you another example. Two other arrests made in Southington also began with hits on the devices. Police say an East Hartford man was found in a stolen car with several sets of car keys. Yes. Obviously, he was going to write a new treatise on interstellar radiation in his PhD study at Harvard. And a New Britain man was arrested on various charges, including drug possession and risk of injury to a minor. Southington Police Lieutenant Keith Egan said, essentially, we put these cameras in locations that we felt would give us the best opportunity to capture vehicles that would be coming into town or leaving town that would be of interest to us. Egan declined to disclose how many cameras the town has and where they are. Of course he did.
Excuse me, Mr. Policeman, yes, I'm with the press. I'm with the media. Can you tell us exactly where those license plate readers are? Because we like to run a special five-part series on where they are.
So the bad guys and bad girls can know where they are. Egan said, well, but there's some people, you know, ACLU, they want that. Egan said, quote, we've had some really big success stories recently in terms of stolen vehicles. We've made sizable drug arrests and recovered guns. A 12-year-old Vernon girl who went missing in October was later found in New York in part because Vernon police, now get this, this is why you have to have these license plate readers out there, and this is why if politicians or if lawmakers or if civil rights groups or whatever demand to the cops, you have to let us know where those license plate readers are. The cops should tell all those groups to go pound sand. A 12-year-old Vernon girl who went missing in October was later found in New York in part because Vernon police were able to track a vehicle of interest using stationary license plate readers. Quote, it definitely came into play in that case. Police recovered a notification of a vehicle of interest based on the last known location of the child, and they were able to track the vehicle using, quote, a wide selection of cameras in town. However, there you go. Here it comes. While law enforcement officials are touting the technology as another useful tool, David McGuire, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Connecticut, said the recent arrest using the devices does not change our view on this. Honestly, I understand where they have a concern about privacy. By the way, you don't have privacy when you're outside. You don't. Understand that? Hello, you have no privacy when you are driving a vehicle on a public thoroughfare. Now, here's what David McGuire said, and he's just wrong on this, and the cops will tell him he's wrong. Honestly, community engagement and traditional law enforcement methods would often result in the same outcome, unquote. Where does he buy his weed? Can I find out? So you mean to tell me, Mr. McGuire, and I think I've had him on the air once at another time at another station. So you mean to tell me that community engagement would have been able to help track down that 12-year-old girl, or community engagement would have been, people would be running in Waterbury to identify the two guys they arrested with fentanyl, other drugs, a modified gun, and whatever. Oh, sure, the community, those communities are just dying to talk to the cops. McGuire added there should be a balance between what he views as an intrusive technology in keeping the public safe. License plate readers are not the silver bullet. Who's saying that? Do you think there's any cop out there or any law enforcement official who's going to say, yep, this is it, the silver bullet? No. The cops, the very people that Hearst interviews here, saying this was a helpful tool. See, folks, the reason I'm bringing this up is we're getting into the legislative season now in a few weeks in January, and you watch. There are going to be some people in Hartford among the leadership and even some Republicans, sad to say, from what I'm reading here, who are going to say, well, you know, we have to have regulations about this stuff and we have to and transparency and all this. No, stop it. It's working. Leave it alone. If you're driving a vehicle with a license plate outdoors, outside, you've got no privacy. If you're not a crook, if you're not a gangbanger, if you're not running drugs, if you're not transporting kids, what's the problem? All right, great to have you with us here as we ease into another weekend. Going to have a big storm moving in here. It's going to be mild, but heavy rain, I think, later part of Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So do be careful of that. We'll get to open phones momentarily, and when we do, we'll be at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. We often hear the term populism. He's a Republican populist. She's a progressive populist, or there's a libertarian populist. Well, not surprisingly, We don't really know, or most people don't know, the origins of that word, who made it famous, and why it even exists. We'll talk to our next guest about that. The name of the book is Forgotten Populace, When Farmers Turn Left to Save America. Dr. Steve Babson, longtime educator and author, joins us. Steve, hi, it's Paul at WICC in Connecticut. How are you?
I'm doing fine. A pleasure being here.
Steve, define a populist for me, or a populism. It gets tossed around like a piece of candy now, but what do we mean by a populist?
Well, what I mean is based on my work as an historian. I think there's a lot of pundits who use the term as a sort of loose reference to rhetoric, to the way people talk. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that has much substance. What I think is more relevant is looking back at the forgotten populace of our American history in the 1890s. And the original populace were calling for changes when farmers, railroad workers, and coal miners, and a wide range of reformers decided to launch a new movement that would change the political terrain of this country. Its official name was the People's Party, but they called themselves populists as a kind of shorthand. And what they were angry about was the way in which both the Democrats and the Republicans were favoring the rising class of corporate robber barons, the people like Andrew Carnegie and Vanderbilt and Jay Gould and, of course, John Rockefeller. And they had all come to power, those robber barons, after the Civil War, mm-hmm. using violence and bribery and monopoly power to crush opponents of big business. And so the populists were about building an alternative movement that would challenge that corporate elite and implement positive reforms that would democratize the economy and reestablish and support American democracy. That's what they were about. When farmers turned left to save democracy, that's what the populist movement was about.
So, Steve, did this lay the seeds or plant the seeds, no pun intended, for the eventual union movement here in the U.S.?
In a lot of ways, it was a major contributor. And in fact, one of the co-founders of the populist movement was the Knights of Labor, which was the first mass-based multiracial labor movement in the United States. And they, along with the Farmers Alliance, is what came together to form the Populist Party in the early 1890s. And so, yeah, there was definitely a movement there to support the rights of working people and farmers to assert themselves collectively on behalf of their self-interest and counter the extraordinary power that was wielded by these corporate robber barons at that time. Remember, this is a period when this new industrial elite, this new industrial economy, was almost totally unregulated. Mm-hmm. And there was no social safety net. There was no unemployment benefits. There was no Medicare. There was no Social Security, nothing to support working people when they were thrown out of work or when their markets collapsed, as happened in the early 1890s. And so they wanted to regulate that economy. They wanted to put boundaries on what big business could get away with. They wanted to stop the price gouging that monopoly corporations were conducting. A whole range of reforms. They included, by the way, an expansion of democracy. They wanted votes for women, and they had a multiracial movement in the South that challenged the white supremacists of that region. So they were about expanding democracy to counter big business.
You say in the title, when farmers turned left, prior to that turn, Steve, did they lean right? Were they apolitical? Were they distributed on both sides? Were they centrist? They turned left from where?
Well, basically across the spectrum and often enough divided into smaller groups. What was important about the Farmers Alliance, which was the social base of the populist movement, was that it really galvanized a broader movement of bringing together farmers across the South and into the Great Plains, weaker, of course, in the Northeast, but nevertheless, bringing together farmers in a way that amplified their voice. They had been speaking out against the abuses of the emerging corporate interests, but they had not done so effectively until the Populist Party really launched them in a major way to challenge that unfettered power of monopoly capital.
Who, Steve, were some of the big personalities of this leftward movement and bulking up politically and economically by farmers? Maybe a couple of three names that people should know about and read about in your book.
Well, one would be Annie Diggs, who was in Kansas. And she was among the many women who joined this movement. This was the first political party to open its ranks to women, who, of course, at that time did not have the vote. But the populace were a major influence in pushing for votes for women. And so Annie Diggs was one of the people who persuaded the populist party in Kansas to endorse women's suffrage. And, of course, indeed, it was the populist party's elected officials in Idaho and Colorado, where they successfully took control of the state government, had a major influence on it. And in both cases, they were the first states to pass votes for women. Another man would be John Rayner, an African-American in Texas. He was born in Virginia to an enslaved mother, and his father was the plantation owner. And he left Virginia, moved to Texas, and became a minister and a school teacher. And he was part of what represented an interracial aspect of the populist movement, especially in the South, where the populist pushed for an economic alliance of black and white farmers who were being gouged by lenders charging interest rates of sometimes 40 to 100% interest on loans for vital supplies and food. They wanted, the populist wanted, a postal savings bank that would loan money at 2% interest. Obviously, a huge matter of improvement for their living standards, if that had been successful at the time. It wasn't. But at the same time, the populist had such an impact on the Democratic and Republican parties, both of which favored this rising elite of corporate oligarchs. They had such an impact and gained so much actual leverage politically. They sent 50 members to Congress. They elected six governors across the United States. They were actually gaining momentum. And that's what persuaded the Democratic Party to actually start adopting some elements of the populist program. And in 1896, the Democratic Party turned in a new direction under the leadership of William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president that year, 1896, as a popocrat, as they called him. He wasn't a populist, but he had adopted enough of the platform to make a difference. And from there on, the Democratic Party takes on a different trajectory through American history.
The name of the book, Forgotten Populists, When Farmers Turned Left to Save Democracy. Steve Babson, the guest. Steve, you know, I'm a bit of a historian. I love reading stuff like your book. And a few decades after that, I've read a couple of books about the 1948 election, the famous, you know, Dewey defeats Truman screw up there. And there are passages in that book when Harry Truman and his handlers are shocked to see when they did that train barnstorming through the Midwest, that when they stopped and spoke in front of mainly farmers and agriculture workers, they were shocked, Steve, in the years after that, to see big cars, airplanes of these farmers that would come in if they knew Mr. Truman was coming through. And I read where historians like yourself, you know, that was a testament to the economic power and the socio-political power that some of these farmers ended up having.
Well, those farmers that were arriving in airplanes and big cars were probably not representative of the bulk of U.S. farmers. But it is important that actually the New Deal represented a culmination of some of the populist influence on the Democratic Party in terms of a reform agenda that provided a social safety net for workers and farmers, price supports for farmers, low-cost loans for farmers, and other assistance. Actually, 40 years later, it was part of the populist program that was being vindicated there. What changed, though, and this is maybe part of what you're getting at, is that in the 1890s, when farmers were the social base of this populist movement, and then the popocrat movement within the Democratic Party, the farmers and farm workers represented about 45% of the economically active adult population, 45%. The percentage today is 2%. And there are still family farmers struggling to make their way, but it's now mostly agribusiness and farmers who are now contractors to companies like Tyson Foods, and they operate on a really short choke collar of a contract stipulating what they can do, what they can buy, how much they can sell, what price they sell it for, all controlled by Tyson and others of these major corporations. So farmers have gone through a dramatic change. And, and what you're talking about is an event sort of halfway along that process.
So today, Steve Babson, as we head into another election cycle, 2023 into 2024, it was great the things they did. They've been now baked in and sewn into the American political and socioeconomic safety net part of the country. But who are the populace now? They sowed the seeds. Who is reaping in present day, Steve Babson, the fruit or the crops, shall we say, no pun intended, of what these populace did in the late 1800s?
Well, I would say people like Bernie Sanders come the closest to representing the populist legacy. In other words, an effort to augment the democratic power of the public, workers and farmers, to protect workers and farmers against otherwise the unfettered and unregulated workings of big business. I don't think Donald Trump has anything to do with what the populists were about in the 1890s. It's the term has now become basically a sort of sly pejorative. It's a way of suggesting that anyone so named is a little bit of a demagogue and maybe not entirely trustworthy. And that perspective goes back to the 1890s. The economic elite of that day that controlled the media, that controlled the private universities, that dominated higher education, they were really alarmed by and hated the populace because they were a challenge to their privileged position. And that animosity has continued ever since. And so anyone who now challenges the status quo from the right or left is sort of derisively referred to as a populist. And that's too bad to my mind. I think they have a positive impact on American history, have transformed the political terrain in a lot of ways. And I'm not sure I want to revive the term these days. I think actually it makes more sense to call people what they are. And Bernie Sanders is a progressive. He's a democratic socialist, and that's what his politics are about. And Donald Trump is a demagogue, and I would say a kind of a budding fascist.
Name of the book is Forgotten Populace, When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy. Pick it up. It came out this past March. Check it out, of course, Amazon.com and your local bookseller, local bookstore, Barnes & Noble. And all that. Steve Babson has been the guest. Steve, thank you. We appreciate it. Good luck with the book, and hopefully we can talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you much.
Appreciate it. There you go. Pick it up. Fascinating chapter in American history. Forgotten Populace, When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy. Hey, before we wrap it up and go back to open phones later on to 203-333-9422-333-WICC, have an update today, yes, as Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy is continuing to negotiate with Kyrsten Sinema, the independent from Arizona, and the Republican Jim Langford from Oklahoma about major, huge changes here, the rumors are, to immigration laws. So we have an update coming up for you. I recorded a few minutes ago from MSNBC. So whatever happens with this immigration law, a Connecticut member of Congress is going to have a large stamp on it. And maybe this adds to his resume for 2028, perhaps. Chris Caruso joins us. We haven't spoken to him in the past couple of weeks. Chris, good afternoon, sir, on this Friday. How are you?
Good afternoon, Paul. Doing well. Excuse my voice. It's a little raspy.
Yeah.
We'll try to get through the interview here.
Well, Chris, there's no pressure here. So if you got it,
I know.
So Chris, what's on your mind here? I guess I'll lead off with this, and then you could add whatever. It's gotten kind of quiet, Chris, on the mayoral race here in Bridgeport. What do you hear? What's going on?
Well, I'm sure those two campaigns don't think it's too quiet because they've got to get things up and running. They've got what, 6 weeks or so to January 23rd. So they're probably doing things. But, you know, we're smack in the middle of the holiday season, and the voters, I don't think, are thinking at all about the election. They're thinking about their family and friends and gift buying and a celebration and all that type of stuff. So I think it's going to be a challenge for the candidates to get their message out in time for the January 23rd primary. And then keep in the middle of at the end of January, the weather is often not the greatest. So there's going to have to be a big effort to get people out to vote and throw into the mix the judge's order that the absentee ballot applications aren't going to be allowed to be dispersed until December 29th. So that gives the campaigns roughly about a month, you know, to get the applications out and people are interested in voting by absentee can do so. So add it all together and it's chaos, that's for sure, you know.
And Chris, I was talking with Linda Grimaldi a couple of weeks ago, and just off the top of his head, between the incumbent mayor Joe Ganim's campaign and now what we have here and the Gomes campaign, I mean, we're looking at, and, you know, Lenny ran the numbers, something approaching, when this is all said and done, Chris, $1 million to be raised and spent in this campaign cycle. Did you ever think you would see, now granted, we're going to have extra rounds here. I mean, this is like the sports playoffs here, but did you ever think you would see such a high dollar figure as that?
Well, you know, we've seen it in past years, Paul. Joe Ganim in particular, years ago, I remember one election cycle, he raised close to $600,000.
Wow.
But as far as both campaigns reaching $1 million, no, I haven't seen that. And especially from a challenger, you know, in John Gomes' case, usually the challenger, it's a struggle to raise money, but in his case, he was able to raise it, which I think made him competitive against the sitting incumbent. If he wasn't able to raise that money, I think the results would have been different, of course. You know, he put a lot of money into, you know, with any challenger, they've got to get name recognition, right? The mayor doesn't because he's known, he's been the mayor. But a challenger has to get name recognition. So as I recall, John Gomes put a lot of money into billboards, bus stop signage, bus signs, and so forth to get the message out there that he was running and to identify himself to voters. And, you know, he did that successfully. And I think that was one of the reasons for the closeness in the results. Also, the absentee ballot abuse. And let me tell you, because I want to make this clear.
Sure.
On both sides. It wasn't just Joe Ganim. It was also on John Gomes' side. Now, I would never say that either candidate were involved directly in that. But the truth be told, both campaigns were, there was absentee ballot abuse. And the videos show that. It's that the facts are the video. The truth is the video. So, you know, I think at this point, though, I think both sides will probably be careful how to deal with the absentee ballots, and rightfully they should. And it may just come down to, for the most part, be a machine vote, which is the actual ballots that people cast when they go to the polls. However,
yeah,
you know, you're at the end of January, you've got a lot of elderly people, people mm-hmm. with disabilities that aren't going to be able to get to the polls because of the weather. And so absentee ballots will be used. But my hope is, and, you know, I'll say this publicly, Paul, the state Secretary of State has appointed an election monitor. And frankly, I think from what I was reading, the monitor gets about $150,000 to monitor the election.
Yeah.
And if the monitor shows up on primary day, January 23rd, you know what you should do? Just thank the $150,000 and fire the monitor. Okay? You know, the monitor has to be involved the day that the absentee applications are dispersed, the 29th of December. That monitor has to be there, and they have to be monitoring from that day until the absentee ballots are actually open and counted on election night, January 23rd.
Mm-hmm.
And that means the monitor should visit households, knock on the door, say to a voter, you know, is everything okay? Was the ballot taken from you? Was it mailed by someone else? You know, do some checking on these things to make sure that things are done properly. And so when January 23rd comes around, whoever wins, the accusations of absentee ballot abuse is not going to be as it's been right along. And so, you know, I call on the Secretary of State. I know Joe Ganim, according to the paper, had sent out a letter to the Secretary of State, and her retort was, well, she administers election. No, she's the chief election official for the state of Connecticut, as defined in statute. So you can't walk away from a problem. Get the monitor. You're paying a buck and a half to the monitor. Get the monitor to come down here and do the job. It will be about a month worth of effort for $150,000. Can you make 150 beans in a month, Paul?
Not legally.
No, that's right. Pretty good money if you can get it, right?
Yeah, and, so. And Chris, on this topic, and we'll wind up with this. I know your voice is a little shaky here, but it's interesting that we seem to have this merry-go-round when you bring up something like that, right? Or anybody does to the Secretary of the State's office. We get kind of this, and I don't know whether she's changed her tone now, but we always got from Denise Merrill when she was there and previous to her, well, my hands are tied. I've got to get a complaint before I act on something. Well, Chris, is that either BS or do we maybe have to change the statute to give the secretary's office a little more beef here? What is it?
I think it's both. One, the statute has to be changed to give more authority of oversight for the elections. Unfortunately, in Connecticut, because we're 169 towns, each town has their own registrar of voters and town clerk. And they take great umbrage when the Secretary of State wants to come in and do something. And they argue, well, you don't have the statutory authority. So that's one thing. And the other thing is somewhat BS, because, frankly, the Secretary of State is an elected official. They have to go to the state conventions and garner votes by the delegates. And in Bridgeport, it's over, 60-some-odd delegates?
Mm-hmm.
It's a big chunk. So they don't want to come in and get into a middle of a food fight, because that could affect their right to be elected again. So, you know, there's two. There's the political side, and there's the practical side under statute. So both, you know, I tried when I was GAE chairman to make changes with the Secretary of State to give them more power. And sure enough, the towns, through their registrars or the town clerks, it was as if, you know, we were, taking their firstborn, you know.
They gave you the malocchio is what they did.
Oh, they know that they did, but I had the horns on around my neck, the horns. So I was okay. I was protected, you know.
Yeah. Chris, thanks. Appreciate it. Now go get some chicken soup and some pastina, and your voice will be fine.
Yeah. You know, it's allergies. I get this every now and then, you know.
All right, Chris, be good. We'll talk next week. Thank you, sir.
Care.
All right, Chris Caruso there.